The Senate Committee on Health Policy open. I'm going to open a subcommittee of two, actually, until we have the rest of us here. I want to move things very quickly. I want to end this by 3 o'clock and have everything done by 3 o'clock. I know we have a lot of testimony, so I'm going to be limiting you. So please don't feel offended when I cut you off after a couple of minutes, all right? Because I want to try to get through everybody. I'd like to have Peter Courtney start. We are first going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1 on mental health parity, a very important issue to so many of us in this building. And I call Peter Courtney to speak first.
Chair Montesanderson and members of the abstentia of the Senate Health Policy Committee. I'm Peter Courtney. I'm State Senator from District 11, includes parts of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. I live at 2925 Islandview Drive North here at Salem Line 7303. I'm also a member, an honored member of this committee. It's a privilege to serve with you, Chair Montesanderson, to be on this committee. Like all of you, we are frequently asked about our priorities in the session. I won't go over mine, but then the last thing I say is that I have no more important priority than Senate Bill 1. In fact, you'll notice it is Senate Bill 1, and as a presiding officer, I have the authority to take the first 10 Senate bills and assign them, and I made that to be number 1. We did the same thing last session, Senate Bill number 1, which is this bill, the Mental Health Priority Bill. In recent years, our society has made great strides in our understanding of mental health. Unfortunately, while we now speak of the mentally ill with compassion, our state is far behind the times in how we deal with our own mentally ill population.
Pull the microphone, please.
Our programs are inadequate. Our facilities are inhuman. I'm haunted by what I saw when I toured the Oregon State Hospital last year. The decrepit conditions of that facility represents a moral failure on the part of all of us. We have a lot of work to do in Oregon to bring our facilities and our treatment capacity into the 21st century. Fortunately, I am sensing that the legislature's readiness to tackle this issue is greater than ever before. It's gaining momentum. Today, we take up one aspect of that task force, one aspect. Senate Bill 1 is about priority, equality for those suffering from mental illness in our state. It is a simple bill. Would require health insurers to extend coverage for mental health conditions on the same terms that apply to physical health conditions. 35 states already do this in some form. Oregon does not. In Oregon, a patient with diabetes can receive the entire recommended course of treatment, and her private insurer will pay. A patient with a crippling bipolar disorder, on the other hand, may be told that she is entitled to 10 doctor visits over her lifetime. After that, she is left with no coverage. She will either incur enormous medical bills, land in our overburdened public system, or simply go untreated, where her illness may then manifest itself in physical ailments, which of course would be covered often at much greater expense. This defies logic, economics, and compassion. Perhaps this is why 35 other states have decided to do things differently. I am not a healthcare expert, as all of you have learned in the short time I have been on this committee. I know the problems with our healthcare system are numerous and that this bill is not the solution to all of them. But I offer this bill because I think it should be part of the solution. There are plenty of experts here today who can answer your questions, provide you with the statistics and data, and speak with much greater understanding of what we are doing wrong and how we need to fix it. I hope that I am introducing Senate Bill 1 for the last time. I look forward to hearing the remaining testimony today, and I request your strong support for this bill. I want to thank you very much, Chairman. As you probably noticed, I read that pretty quickly because I'm overly sensitive to the fact that we recently had a discussion as to whether legislators should speak when the public has turned out. So I hurried through the testimony. I don't like to do that. I handed out the testimony, and with that, I'd say I'm open for questions, but I don't think you want me to take any questions. You want me to get up and go sit where am I supposed to sit and be done.
Senator Kate Barham. Okay, I now will open the full committee of the Senate Health Committee.
Good afternoon, committee, members of the Committee on Health Policy. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. And again, I will be brief. I've asked Mrs. Linda Riley to come forward with me. She's a constituent. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1. Like my Senate President, I hope this is the last and final time that we will have the opportunity to testify on this bill. Over 10 years ago, when I came to the Oregon Legislature, I had the opportunity to work with the Riley family. Linda and her husband contacted me because at the time, under state law, they were required to relinquish custody of their daughter when she was admitted to residential treatment for mental illness. Working with the Riley family and a number of others, we were able to pass legislation that session, that was 1993, that would keep families together as they negotiated treatment for mental illness for their children. I'm here today for that very same reason. For years, I've been urging both the House and the Senate to take action on mental health parity. From my perspective, mental health parity is about keeping families whole as they receive very basic mental health treatment. We know that when individuals with mental illness and chemical dependency receive adequate treatment, symptoms are reduced, adolescents learn and thrive, and adults are able to work and participate as productive members of society. You're going to hear from a lot of people. I want to thank these families that are coming forward to tell their stories, but more than anything, I urge you, I beg you, I plead you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not here to give testimony, so I won't take any precious minutes. I just want to thank you. I've given testimony before. There will be new faces. Yes, there will be new faces.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Linda Riley from Portland, Oregon. Do you need the address? Okay. And I just wanted to thank you all for holding this hearing, and you'll be hearing from others.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to call Jonathan Ader, and Aaron Kelly Seal, and Kathy Loretz. And if you can keep your comments brief, many of us have heard this testimony every session, so it isn't like you don't need to educate us.
Senator, I'll be very brief and start. I'm Jonathan Ader from Portland, Oregon. I was co-chair of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. I'm also vice chair of the state's Health Policy Commission. I've had the pleasure of serving with Senator Cruz on that commission. The parity recommendation is a foundation recommendation of the Governor's Task Force report. The reasons are well articulated in the report, and there's a good deal of supporting information. I commend the entire report to you to the extent that you're interested in practical, efficient, and cost-effective solutions to improving mental health care in Oregon. I want to say just quickly, the economic rationales for proceeding are apparent. The direct costs of parity coverage are increasingly shown to be nominal and probably more than offset by the directly measurable benefits, not to mention the immeasurable benefits. I also want to say this is a very important foundation step for you to take in terms of implementing some of the other things that we're trying to do in terms of bringing quality and access and a quality health care system generally to Oregon, which is a very important pro-business position. Our health care system needs to work and be effective. I am an employer, and I understand the importance of that perhaps as much as anybody else in the room. I've offered your administrator to be available as a resource to the committee as you work through this, and I'm not going to take any more time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Kelly Seal. I am Governor Kulongoski's Health and Human Services Policy Advisor, and I'm here today on behalf of the governor to state his emphatic support for passage of Senate Bill 1. I think in Oregon we like to think of ourselves as pioneers, innovators, especially in the area of health care. And so it is even more remarkable, I think, in that light, that Oregon today is just one of a few states that doesn't have significant group health insurance parity for mental health and substance abuse disorders. I would submit to you that the time is long overdue for us as a state to explicitly recognize through our policy that meeting an individual's health care needs holistically, including their mental health and physical health care needs, is the best kind of treatment that we can give them. That means ending health insurance discrimination against mental health and substance abuse disorders and requiring fair and equal treatment. As the Senate Health Policy Committee, I know that you all have already heard a lot about cost, quality, and access, and I just want to quickly address each of those as they relate to Senate Bill 1. The argument most often made against parity is that it will increase health insurance costs. One of the best things about being last to the table as a state in Oregon on this issue is that we can learn from the experience of others. And what that experience has shown is that the cost increase of parity is minimal, if any, at all. And especially that is especially true when you look at the offset. And if you just look at them from an economic standpoint to employers, when you look at costs, when you look at costs of other physical health services, absenteeism, productivity, claims for disability and unemployment insurance, those costs more than outweigh the cost of parity. And when parity has been implemented in other states, large corporations have experienced that testify to the fact that cost, the minimal cost of parity is more than upset. In terms of quality, you will hear from others today with more expertise than I about the effectiveness of mental health and substance abuse treatment and how those treatments have become more and more effective over time, equally so to the physical health treatment that we provide folks. You'll also hear from individuals and family members with direct personal experience about the impact of early effective treatment on mental health and substance abuse. It is very clear that the prevalence of mental health and addiction disorders today suggests that each of you, just like myself, has had a direct contact, either someone we know or indirectly, with mental health or substance abuse disorder, and there is just no arguing against the fact that early effective care improves the quality of those individuals' lives. In terms of access, both quality and cost are related to access, and in health policy, one of the things that we like to say that we know is that insurance typically improves access to care. Not so the case in Oregon right now with respect to mental health and substance abuse. In fact, our insurance policy as a state is creating a barrier, and so I'm asking you today to think of Senate Bill 1 as a way to improve access for folks through their private insurance policies. I just want to close by saying that Senate Bill 1 equates to support for the big three in health policy, if you will, reducing health care costs, improving quality, and improving access to care. And with that, I'm open to questions, but I'll let Kathy get started.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Thank you. Aaron, I'm confused. You said our policy is a barrier. I don't understand that. I mean, I own a business. I offer health insurance to my employees. If they wanted a mental health substance abuse benefit, I could get it for them, couldn't I?
If you choose to purchase it.
Right. I mean, that would be a decision based on, in my case, small business. I understand that. But if they wanted it, I could purchase it for them. So I'm trying to figure out where the barrier is if it's a product that's available.
If your choice is not to purchase and those individuals expire the benefits that they have under the existing policy, then it's much harder for them to have access to the treatment that they need on a continuing basis.
But I could still purchase the benefit,
that's
right?
True.
Okay, thank you.
Kathy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide information related to Public Employees Benefit Board's experience of having parity for both substance abuse and mental health benefits. My name is Kathy Loretz, and I am the Director of Operations for the Public Employees Benefit Board. I'm on the right page here. For the state of Oregon, our medical carriers have offered parity to the state of Oregon for substance abuse since back in 2000. We do not track any of the utilization changes or the costs related to the parity for substance abuse. In 2002, we had two medical carriers, Kaiser and Regents Blue Cross. The mental health benefits offered by these two carriers were slightly different, but both benefits were much higher than the state-mandated minimum. The benefit period began the first day a member accessed mental health benefits and were based on a 24-month period. I have included a table that shows the difference in the benefits between Kaiser and Regents in 2002. In 2003, at the request of the board, Kaiser and Regents began offering parity for mental health benefits to state employees and their families. Kaiser implemented full parity with utilization managed through their internal processes. PEB does not track the costs or utilization changes related to Kaiser's mental health parity. However, we do track the cost and utilization changes related to the Regents plan. In 2003, Regents began offering unlimited outpatient visits, 45 residential days per 12-month period and unlimited inpatient days. The 45-day residential care benefit is not full parity, but it is much richer than the 2002 benefit, and it does mirror this Senate Bill 1 language. At the time, Regents moved to parity for mental health benefits. Utilization management mechanisms were put in place through an outside contractor. They used Reliant Behavioral Health. These mechanisms included prior authorization for both residential and inpatient services, and a requirement that a practitioner submit a treatment plan after 8 outpatient visits. The use of utilization management tools has been instrumental in managing the cost of the mental health parity benefits for the state. And I've also included a chart showing the 2003 benefits. The mental health parity benefits with Regents included a prepayment of the estimated cost of the benefit, and we prepaid a 1% of our premiums to Regents. At the end of the year, we then do a reconciliation of the cost of those benefits against the 1% prepayment. In 2003, we did find that 3% of the PAB members utilizing outpatient services, 57% of members using residential care, and 15% of our members utilizing inpatient care exceeded the 2002 limitation. We have done the reconciliation for the 2003 year, and we found that the cost was slightly over $1 million compared to the 2002 limitations. Total cost of the Regents mental health parity benefit for 2003 was 0.42% of our premiums. When considering the cost of increasing mental health benefits to the current Regents level, it is important to remember that the 2002 benefits were higher than those mandated by the states. So other groups that may not have, that may just have the minimum mandated amount, may have a different cost associated with mental health parity. The use of the 24-month individual benefit clock adds a dimension of uncertainty as we look forward. Since each member has a different benefit period, there's no way of knowing how many will or will not exceed the limits in the future. And finally, we just like to say that 1 year does not make a trend. A continued analysis of the benefit changes needed to determine the ongoing fiscal impact of any parity to our benefits. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
You said that 57% of your membership utilizes residential care?
No, 57% of the members utilizing residential care exceeded the 2002 benefits. So.
Okay. What percent of your, could you give us information on what percent of your membership utilized benefits? I mean, obviously I misread that, but I'm thinking that's
sure.
More than half your workforce is in residential care. That's probably a crisis.
No, sir. Of those members.
We may need to look at some.
And
things.
The other half are in the legislature.
Yeah. I know government service can be tough, but still.
Of those members that utilize residential care, 57%. Of those used had more residential days than the 2002 left.
Okay.
Yes. And
that's not quite as disturbing a number.
Oh no. And if you'd like more information,
does that
do it? Okay.
That's fine.
Any other discussion? Okay. Thank you. I'd like to call Bob Nickel, Tim Harnett, and Dr. Connie Powell.
I handed out testimony. Right. See, I'm kind of personally pleased with the full service. I think you're fine mentally, but you know, I think you're
good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1. I won't repeat all of the many good arguments that you will hear this afternoon and those that are in my testimony. I do want to just comment on the enormous pressure that's on the community mental health and addiction systems. And although this bill will not save funds for us, it would do a great deal to relieve some of the enormous stress that's on our community, our publicly funded community mental health and addiction system. And I think rather than spend a lot more time going over many of the arguments you will hear, I just want to say that I really think that this is the right thing for Oregon to do. We've already done this, in effect, in the Oregon Health plan, and there, in a sense, there is parity for mental health, addiction services, as well as physical health care for those people who are on the Oregon Health Plan, and I think this moves us in that same direction with the private insurance industry. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Connie Powell, and I'm a psychiatrist in private practice in Portland, and a past president of the Oregon Psychiatric Association and a past president of the Oregon Medical Association. And I'm here to reflect the positive position of support of both of those organizations. This bill does not affect the economic well-being of these membership organizations, but is in line with their missions to advocate for patients. As we all know at this point, mental illness is common. I've never had to define depression. We have all had some experience with it. In most cases, it resolves on its own. When it requires treatment, it's a different matter. It is a continuum of severity. And half of the cases of depression are diagnosed in the primary care office. Of those, half of them are treated in that context effectively, either with first-line medications or because the illness essentially resolves on its own. When that does not happen and there is no resolution, the primary care physician would like to be able to refer to the next line of specialty, as they do with all other illnesses such as heart problems that are not within the scope of their usual practice. I get a referral of a patient. When I talk to that patient, this is at the point that the care needs exceed the primary care setting. I ask the patient if they have medical insurance that covers psychiatric care. And typically the patient says, "Well, yes, I have medical insurance." They do not necessarily know that though they have medical insurance, any mental health needs that they have are not necessarily covered. So I ask them to ask their carrier, since it's very hard to discern this from the booklets, as you probably all know, in the interest of trying to be complete, sometimes these booklets are hard to understand. In Oregon, someone who works for a company with fewer than 50 employees is unlikely to have insurance coverage for outpatient mental health. This applies to 86% of Oregonians, and so these patients don't know they aren't covered for their illness. Since one in four people has a mental illness, This is a serious problem throughout the population. In an Oregon poll, 23% of people reported that someone in their family had gotten treatment for mental health or alcohol or drug in the last 5 years, and 25% of those people said that none of their costs were covered with insurance. So this is the man on the street. We're talking about any level of severity. My statements before you refer to a number of studies and different situations and a variety of kinds of information supporting the passage of this bill. And if anyone would like to have further underlying support, I would be glad to furnish those. But I'm here just to, on behalf of the organizations, to support covering mental health and substance abuse, saying that it's reasonable. The policy holders expect they have it. They expect it and they deserve it. I would just like to support it. Thank you.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Tim Hartnett. I'm the executive director of CODA, Portland's oldest alcohol and drug treatment agency. I'm here today representing the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program Directors Association of Oregon. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1. Alcohol and drug abuse represents one of the greatest challenges facing our state's families, communities, healthcare providers, businesses, and other institutions. Alcohol and drug abuse are a root cause or contributing factor in virtually every health and social concern Oregonians face. Rising healthcare costs, traffic fatalities, poor work performance, work-related accidents, divorce, domestic violence, crime, teen pregnancy, environmental hazards, and now terrorism. The list is literally endless. Nowhere else in healthcare is public policy so underwhelming given the scale of and cross-cutting nature of the problem and its impact on public and private spending. There may not be a single issue in healthcare in which public perception and public policy lag so far behind the science. People who suffer from alcohol and drug-related problems continue to be perceived of as a group of weak-willed individuals who will only get better when they see and understand the error of their ways. This fundamental stigma represents a critical element in understanding why we have made limited meaningful progress in the war on drugs and why we still have 14 million Americans who are dependent on alcohol, and most importantly, why alcohol and drug abuse treatments are routinely not a part of health insurance. It's time for public policy to reflect what the American Medical Association and the U.S. Surgeon General have concluded, that individuals suffering from alcohol and drug-related problems are suffering from a medical condition, that treatment for alcohol and drug abuse is at least as effective as treatment for other chronic conditions, and it is one which warrants mandated health insurance coverage that is equal to other medical conditions. Failing to define alcohol and drug abuse as a health problem and provide mandated coverage will only serve to further stigmatize people with alcohol and drug-related problems and continue to drive up costs in other forms of health care and social services. The time is now to support behavioral health parity. Addictions cost Oregonians a lot more when left untreated. We spend millions on treatment of alcohol and drug-related hypertension, liver disorder, industrial industries, and family abuse. Doctors see dramatic numbers of preventable disorders such as hepatitis C, fetal alcohol syndrome, and traumatic spinal cord and brain injuries. Whatever the bill's final form, I would recommend that careful attention be paid to whether or not mandated minimum coverage is actually a benefit of real value. Annual lifetime caps are more restrictive than for other diseases. More stringent limits are placed on inpatient or outpatient visits than for other diseases, and that arbitrary and undisclosed criteria are used to determine if treatment is medically necessary. I strongly urge you to support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Ted Burton, Mark Nelson, and Scott Manchester.
My name is Ted Urton. I'm Vice President and General Manager of Fidelity National Title for the Mid-Willamette Valley. I'm speaking to you today more as a business person than a family man, although I do have mental illness in our family. I'm testifying in behalf of Senate Bill 1. My point today is to talk about one employee in my company and how lack of parity almost cost my company her services. This is an outstanding employee. As our business grew, our title plant manager in March 2001 hired a quality individual we will call Mary to protect her confidentiality. Just prior to her hire date, she experienced four life-altering events. Her father passed away in September 2000. Her son was born December 2000. Shortly thereafter, her husband was laid off from his job. Then her job was eliminated, and she became unemployed until we picked her up in March of 2001. Within a month of her hiring, she and her husband declared bankruptcy. However, from March until June of 2001, she was very dependable and fast. Mary performed a variety of high-speed, complex, multitasks utilizing computers, printers, and her phone system in a very fast-paced business environment. Other employees were very pleased with her performance. Her work was exemplary. She was very dependable and well-liked. However, during the remaining half of the year 2000, Mary said that she became very tired and depressed. She used up all of her vacation and sick time and took several days without pay due to various mental, that's her words, various mental issues. Her attendance became very spotty. In January 2002, she was given a written notice by my company to work on improving her attendance. Sensing something was really wrong, she used her health care benefits to seek medical advice. By the end of January 2002, she took a short-term leave of absence on doctor's orders. During this time, she was told that she had a chemical imbalance, showed she was suffering from severe depression, was placed on a series of medications, and attended attended mental health counseling sessions 3 times per week for the first month of her leave. Instead of being gone 1 month, she actually was gone 4, returning to work in May of 2002. Mary said these initial sessions were very therapeutic, that she felt she began to make real progress on her recovery, but was surprised when the counseling sessions were cut back to 2 times per week during the second month. Subsequently, they were cut back to 1 or 2 times a week during the remainder of the year. She felt the frequency of the earlier counseling was making her heal faster. She felt the progress of her recovery slow as the intervals between counseling sessions lengthened. However, just as she was adjusting to the 1 session per week, she received a letter from her health care provider in December 2002 indicating she had just 12 counseling sessions remaining. Her coverage called for not more than 40 visits within a 2-year period, which actually, when compared to other health care plans, is more generous. Generally, they allow 24 to 36 visits in a 2-year period. In the year 2003, she exhausted those remaining visits, but thanks to a compassionate mother-in-law, she received money to continue the sessions. She says she needed these expensive extra out-of-pocket sessions to get firmly back in track and build up her energy and resolve to return to work at our company. Not everyone has such a generous mother-in-law. Mary indicated that if she had not, had it not been for this generosity and given her family's financial weakness, she does not believe she would have escaped her depression, nor does she believe she would be working with us today. Limitations imposed by her insurer on mental health coverage nearly cost this individual her ability to return to work as a productive, healthy, tax-paying citizen and outstanding employee. This brings me to my points today. Lack of parity almost cost me the loss of a super individual, a fine employee. These limitations on complete and speedy recovery, I believe, subject my employees to increased absenteeism, reduced productivity, greater risk of being laid off, and ultimately, if the latter does occur, it subjects my company to higher claims for disability and unemployment insurance. In doing a little bit of research, I discovered that without parity, my company is not alone when it comes to lower productivity and increased costs. In the United States, the annual economic indirect cost of mental illness is estimated to be about $79 billion. Most of that amount, approximately $63 billion, reflects the loss of work site productivity as a result of mental illness. Also, mental illness ranks first as the leading health reason for diminished work site performance. In addition, mental health ranks second for lost work hours per week. I have documented that with some attachments in the forms that I've given you. Oregon is only one of 7 states which does not require significant group health insurance parity of mental health and substance abuse disorders. Oregon state employees already have parity of insurance coverage at a cost increase of less than half of 1%, 0.42%. That's just half of 1%. They've been doing this for a year. Is it not time for the rest of us to participate in this program? I ask you to please consider the value of the cost savings resulting from full recovery. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator George.
Good to see you again.
Thank you, Senator.
Was it not possible for your company to purchase a complete parity plan?
Well, again, I don't make the decisions regarding our health insurance coverage. This is all corporate and national.
All right.
Okay. And I'm simply advocating that whatever the coverage is for physical illness, I think the same should be allowed for mental illness. And we do far greater damage to our employees and society as a whole by limiting coverage. And then basically, if these people don't have financial means, they're out in the street. What do they do?
Yes, follow up.
In the other locations that your parent company has, do they have required coverage in those areas? And what do the policy look, percentages of increase look like? Were you able to achieve that number?
Senator George, I would be more than happy to look. I don't have any of those numbers. I would be more than happy to check it out. So,
thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Manchester. I'm the executive director of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. We represent over 1,700 professional social workers throughout the state of Oregon and over 150,000 social workers nationwide.
Do you want to move the microphone close?
There's a big, huge sign in front of you that says, please do not move the microphone.
So that sign out.
So I was okay. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1.
NASW knows that there is a need for this legislation. There is a high rate of mental illness in the American population. It's been estimated at up to 20% of the population in any given year, and even more than in other areas of health and medicine, the mental health field is plagued by disparities in the availability and accessibility to mental health services. There is stigma and now an unworded sense of hopelessness about the opportunities for recovery from mental illness because of barriers to coverage and to access. And it's time to take those barriers down. Senate Bill does that by increasing access to treatment. In terms of the cost of care, there are concerns about the cost of care on the part of consumers of health care and mental health care, concerns that are made worse by the disparity in insurance coverage for mental health disorders in contrast to other disorders. And these are among the foremost reasons that people do not seek mental health care. Equality between mental health coverage and other health coverage is important in order to aid such people in finding access to services that they can afford. And parity is also fiscally responsible for, in terms of the cost of coverage. Recent experience in states which have legislation requiring parity indicate that it does not lead to any large increase in costs. In terms of fairness, the Surgeon General's 1999 report on mental health concluded that there is no scientific justification for treating mental health and physical health differently, that diagnoses for mental disorders are made using specific criteria and are as reliable as those for general medical disorders, and that a range of treatments with well-documented efficacy exists for most mental disorders. The success rate for treating clinical depression is over 80%, and recent research done by the National Institute on Drug Abuse confirms that substance abuse treatment reduces use of other healthcare services by 40 to 60% and significantly reduces criminal activity. Mental health parity isn't a new concept. It exists in 32 other states. The experience in those states convinced the federal government to create mental health parity in its health plan, and as of January 1, 2001, and that applies to all federal employees, their dependents, and that includes members of Congress and their staff through the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and it's had a minimum cost impact there. So parity has been studied throughout the country for a number of years. It's time to act in Oregon, and we urge you to support Senate Bill 1.
Thank you. Question? Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, members of committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. Clinical social workers provide about 55% of the mental health outpatient care in Oregon. Many of us have been involved with this issue for a very, very long time. We've heard from legitimate, in some cases, concerns over the years about the cost of a mandate. We believe very strongly that this isn't a mandate, that this is, in fact, an issue of fairness, that, in fact, we need to cover mental health care in the same way that we cover physical care. But having said that, I should mention I'm on the AOI Health Choice Board of Trustees. This is an issue that has come up oftentimes, and I am in agreement with or disagreement with some of my brethren, as you may hear today from some of those members. But there's a legitimate concern, I think, in the past that about the cost of parity. But I think the PEB study and the studies that are coming out of state after state after state are now indicating that that cost is minimal. The PEB study, as you have been told, showed an increase of cost of 0.4%. I should say, however, that in the PEB study, in the PEB benefits, they're slightly higher than the current mandates on mental health. So, but I'm told that that may add as much as just 0.1%, but that should be on the record. I think another piece of data that came out of that study is the fact that 96% of the people who use the mental health benefit in the PEB group, and I think it's about 55,000 people, 96% actually use under the current mandate, actually under. But 4% were over that mandate. And that's what we're talking about, and the most serious mental health care that needs to be taken care of. I should also point out in this bill, and we negotiated this actually 2 years ago with Regents Blue Cross, some case management provisions. One of those is a limitation on the residential care to 45 days. Another is on section or page 4, line 25, that deals with the authority for the insurer to manage the benefit. Makes it absolutely clear that the insurer has the authority to manage the benefit. So this is a bill, I don't want to imply that Regency is supporting the bill. These are amendments that they felt needed to be in the bill to properly handle, be able to handle case management from their point of view, and we happen to agree with that. There have been numerous studies, as has been mentioned, that shows with the infusion of mental health care, you have a dramatic reduction on the physical health side, somewhere between 10 to 20%. So as parity is extended, you will see further reductions on the physical health utilization side. There has been already conversation about the Surgeon General in 1999, estimate $70 billion is lost to businesses, some of which are my clients who have concern about mental health parity and a mandate, but $70 billion as a result of absenteeism, lost productivity, and disability. And so we believe very, very strongly that this, in fact, will save a combination of all those factors I mentioned. Will save businesses in Oregon money rather than costing money. Finally, to touch upon what Scott has said, you have the issue of fairness. If you have schizophrenia, it's not curable, but it's treatable. If you have diabetes, it's not curable, but it's treatable. And if we walked into this room and proposed that we were going to cut off the treatment of diabetes at $10,004, you run us out on a rail. And I propose to you that it is exactly the same thing, that we need to provide fair, equitable treatment between the two, between physical health and mental health. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, oh, Senator Morsette.
Did you turn in do you have that in writing?
No.
He liked it so much he wanted it in writing.
I wanted it in writing.
First time.
That's why I wanted it.
Okay, Chris Anderson and Don Moore and Corinne Spiegel.
I keep saying, what's in your briefcase? What do we need? Hanging on to him one, don't we?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
We could distract him. I'll distract him. You grab the briefcase
yourself. Yeah. Yeah. All right. All right.
Unfortunately, his name's on it, though. That's
okay. Who's going first? Okay.
Okay. Well, I'm Kristen Anderson, and thank you, Chairman Monis Anderson and the rest of the committee for allowing me to be here today. I am the parent of a 9-year-old boy with bipolar disorder, and I implore you to require insurance companies to treat my son's chronic, life-threatening illness like any other illness. Currently, mental illness is treated differently from other physical illnesses. Care is limited, and our copays are higher. I have had to beg for extended coverage. I have made phone calls and written letters all the way up the chain of command. Sometimes the answer has been yes, but more often I've been told, no, we cannot justify extending benefits further. My son's condition is chronic. It will not go away. In fact, without treatment, he has more than a 50% chance of attempting suicide. I don't understand why this difference is allowed to continue. This is 2005, and we know the brain is an organ of the body. We now know that there are biochemical, physiological, and neurological causes for mental illness, and we now know that mental illness can be treated successfully. All I'm asking is that all illnesses be treated the same. Limits in care should apply to all illnesses. If we were to treat all illnesses like mental illness, a patient on dialysis may only be allowed 10 treatments for every 2 years. A patient with AIDS would be allowed 20 days in a hospital for the rest of his life. A patient with a history of heart problems may be told there's only 30 beds available for heart patients in the entire state. They're all full. You'll have to go home and deal with this on your own.
Do you think the parent of a child with leukemia would be told your insurance benefits have run out? The only way the state can help you and your child is if you release custody of your child to the state. That way the state's responsible for your child's care and will be sure your child gets help. Of course, you'll be allowed visitation. That is what parents of children with mental illness are told. The Oregon State Board of Nursing requires all nurses to have a basic understanding of mental health issues. The Oregon Board of Medical Examiners requires all physicians to demonstrate knowledge in the area of mental illness. Our physical medical providers are aware that considering the whole body is essential for complete health care. From the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, it has been documented that people with serious illnesses such as heart disease often develop depression, a mental illness. If the mental illness is not treated also, the risk of death due to the original illness is tripled. Insurance companies often say the cost of parity and treatment would be too high, and this isn't true. In a joint study at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City and Northwestern University, elderly patients having hip replacements were all treated with normal orthopedic care. Approximately 100 of those patients also received mental health care for the depression that often accompanies major surgery. The patients who received treatment for their bodies and minds were released from the hospital earlier, resulting in a savings of $100,000. Brain disorders that visibly affect the body are treated as physical illnesses by insurance companies. This includes illnesses such as cerebral palsy and epilepsy. All brain disorders need to be treated the same as these brain disorders. Complete health includes the mind, and health insurance should be just that, insurance for the whole body, which includes the brain. Thank you for your time and consideration, and if you have any questions.
I admire you for coming here and testifying. Thank you so much.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Don Moore. I live at 1140 Southwest Stevenson in Portland. I appear here today as an advocate, both as a parent and a businessman, for change in the regulations surrounding the coverage of mental health illness by health insurance policies. In 1977, my business career started as a commercial insurance underwriter, during which time I gained valuable understanding in the insurance industry and risk management. Since 1983, I've been a small business owner in the technology industry. As a former insurance professional and as a businessman, I understand the principle of shared risk that coalesced to create the insurance industry. Individuals and companies have come together to share those risks that they could not afford to assume themselves. Over time, though, insurance companies have been allowed to provide an unequal system of benefits as a simplistic measure to reduce costs. However, these measures result in cost shifting and benefit denial directed at the very population who is least able to assume the risk: small business owners, family members, and individuals who are faced with serious mental illness. Recently, I was humbled to sit between two mental health consumers, schizophrenia, who have been victims of this cost shifting. They described their struggles to find sources of medication and treatment services so they could exist in a recovered state and not further burden an already taxed social services system. They spend every day struggling to maintain the recovery in the face of cuts in medical services. While I contemplate the inequity in their having not received equal coverage for their mental illnesses, I wonder what will happen to my daughter when I can no longer help her. In March 2001, while attending a private music college in Minnesota, my eldest daughter, Tracy, was diagnosed with a severe form of mental illness, schizophrenia. During the course of her illness, I gained firsthand experience with the difficulties of her disease, as well as treatment efficacy. From my personal experience, I can assure you, without question, that mental illness in a clinical form is a foe that no one would wish to confront in their life under any circumstances. Left untreated, it can be extremely debilitating. Yet with proper treatment, individuals such as Jane Pauley, who suffers from bipolar disorder, and Mike Wallace, who suffers from depression, of television fame, have led active and productive lives. With access to appropriate health care for mental illnesses, symptoms are moderated and costs are far less than the extraordinary high price of the default alternatives, uncompensated hospital care, public safety systems, and the public safety net. Do not think for a moment that the insurance companies in the state of Oregon do not bear many of these costs in an ultimate manner. As owner of a small business, I can assure you that rising health costs are a concern to everyone in this state. However, allowing another colossal mistake to continue by temporarily shifting costs with greater and greater fiscal consequences into the future, with more prisons, more unpaid hospital visits, along with denied treatment, will not help solve the problems. It's like trying to save money by denying treatment for a high blood pressure until the heart attack victim is admitted to the hospital for the covered hospital visit. If we do not pass legislative action to ward off future problems, we will ultimately pay far greater costs in prisons, medical costs, and destructions of lives and families of Oregonians. Take the correct step now, as 34 other states have done, and secure parity for health treatment today for truly minimal cost, instead of leaving the future taxpayers with an ever-increasing burden of services that citizens struggle to afford. You can leave a legacy to future legislators far better than the legacy left to you by your predecessors. This bill would return insurance to a shared risk concept that most equitably spreads the cost of the insured population without singling out any portion of that pool to assume more than its fair share of the risk. This bill will leave a legacy of fairness and quality of life for Oregonians. Make the right choice. It's the right thing to do.
Thank you. Questions? Discussion?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Corinne Spiegel of Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I thank you for listening to testimony today on this. As new parents, the very first thing that we do is check to make sure that our newborn has all the appropriate body parts. We count fingers and toes, inspecting the baby from head to foot, and then we smile in relief when we realize that everything is in order and that our new baby is perfectly okay. There is no greater relief for a parent than knowing that our kids are just fine. The shock starts later, though, when we realize that there is something wrong with our child's brain. We go to our doctors to seek treatment for that neurologic brain disorder. Somewhere along the way, we discover that our insurance provider does not provide coverage for all of the testing and treatment that is needed. If our child requires hospitalization, the insurance companies, not the doctors, have the final say in how many days per year our child can obtain that prescribed level of care, despite the unpredictable nature of brain disorders. Some insurers that provide treatment for every other body part do not cover treatment for the brain at all. And that's when we wonder why it is that insurance companies doing business in Oregon are allowed to provide medical insurance for only certain parts of our bodies, specifically excluding the brain. I liken it to having a new car that comes with a bumper-to-bumper warranty. Except that with cars, when they say bumper-to-bumper, it does not exclude the most integral part of the car, the engine. All the parts of the car, including the engine, are, if you will, insured by the warranty. For medical insurance providers, the brain is often excluded from coverage. Yet, in a review of states that have enacted medical insurance parity, the feared additional expense to the insurance companies have been nominal, in some cases less than 1%. I'd like to add that about 15 years ago, I provided testimony to a committee here in Salem that was evaluating whether adopted children should be provided medical insurance the same as children born into a family. There was considerable opposition at the time from some insurance providers. I'm pleased that the committee then determined that medical insurers in Oregon must provide comparable coverage to our adopted children. No insurance company went out of business as a result, and no one questions now the practical decision to enact that law. Adopted kids are covered by Oregon insurance companies the same as the rest of the family members. I respectfully ask that this committee recognize the injustice in current law that allows medical insurers to provide coverage for certain parts of the body, but not for brain disorders. And as the parent of a young man with mental illness, I can assure you that the best way for those with mental illness to maintain a productive lifestyle is to receive proper treatment and medication, which will only happen with medical insurance parity. For a person with mental illness who does not receive the proper medical treatment, it too often becomes a mental health crisis and results in a huge burden to the police, the state, and of course to the taxpayers. Thanks again for listening to our testimony today.
Thank you. Discussion?
Yeah. Ann Uller, Phil Chadsey, and Margaret Noel.
I'm Ann Uller. I'm here representing the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Programs. Senator Anderson and committee members, I first want to say congratulations. I've been working on this for 12 years, This is the earliest we've ever gotten a hearing on this issue, and I just want to take my hat off, if I had it on, to you, that we're actually talking about this early in the session. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Part of the job of the Governor's Council is to look at how does alcohol and drug affect all of the state agencies, not just what happens in treatment and prevention. And recently we've had a number of state directors of the departments come to us and talk to us about the effects of alcohol and drug that are having on all of the folks that are in the rest of the state in all of the programs, from transportation. I mean, you name one department and I can give you an example of how addiction is affecting our ability to do the job that we need to do. The Governor's Council supports this parity bill, as it has for many years. We support it because, as you've heard before, addiction is a chronic disease, and based on equity, it seems absurd to think about limiting services to addiction when we wouldn't do the same thing. We would not tell people who have heart disease that you only are covered for one heart attack a year. That's absurd. And yet, that's exactly what we do for addiction and mental health services. We say you're only allowed so much, and beyond that, you have to pay for it yourself. It's also like other, it is a chronic illness, and it's like other chronic illnesses in that treatment works, and it works about the same success rate as other chronic illnesses. There's a genetic predisposition for it, just like there is for heart disease. It affects many parts of the body. If you have heart disease, it affects the rest of your parts of your body and how it works. And it requires lifestyle changes, just like heart disease. You have to eat differently. You have to have more physical exercise. You have to change, and that's also true of addiction. The second reason, so that's my first reason. My second reason that I hope you'll take home with you is to understand that 70% of addicts are employed. 70%. So, and how many of them do not have health care coverage for their illness? Many. And what happens is, when there's not parity in their coverage, then they go have 12 quick sessions. Of course, this is a chronic illness. They may relapse. They lose their job. They become homeless, and they come into the public service sector. They fall into the other services that we have to take public dollars to pay for. So this doesn't just affect business. It affects all of the rest of the services that are provided by this state. One of the things we've heard, and it's very disturbing, is that a number of employers are no longer doing drug testing because if they did, they wouldn't have any employees. That's a result of the methamphetamine epidemic. We have a public health epidemic going on right now in the state. And here we have employers who are hiring people with an addiction, but they have no coverage for their illness. This is a step towards making sure that people have access for the illness that they have. So I implore you, and I'm probably asking the choir, is please pass this and that we no longer stigmatize people with addiction and with mental illness in this state by having a policy that says they have different insurance benefits. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Phil Chadsey.
I'm here as the chairman of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill's Legislative and Public Policy Committee, and I'd like to make about 3 points. Up until recently, I was an employer. I just retired as a partner in a law firm. In answer to Senator Cruz's question earlier, I did ask our insurance person that handles our insurance for our law firm whether or not we could purchase insurance that provided more coverage than the Oregon minimum, and I was told that we could not. So perhaps we don't have as much bargaining power as the PEB board does. Second thing, the argument against parity is basically that it'll cause some small employers to drop their insurance. The one empirical study that I found on the subject involves the state of Vermont, which has probably the most comprehensive insurance policy in parity in the United States. They found that less than 0.3% of the employers would drop their policy when they adopted parity. The other thing is that one of the other issues is whether or not it's going to cost money to have parity. And there is a study that was done in 1999 that of a large employer that had over 20,000 employees that basically had parity and then cut back on parity. And that what that employer found, and this is a study done by the Yale Medical School, it found that when you cut back on parity, your insurance costs for physical illnesses go up, and your lost time goes up from employee absenteeism.
Right here.
The 1999 Surgeon General's report showed that the leading cause of disability in the United States is chronic depression, and so that would be consistent with that employer's experience. The final thing I want to point out is that the recent article or a recent study done by Harvard Law School, Harvard Medical School, on bankruptcy showed that personal bankruptcies, excess medical expenses, are the cause of approximately half of all personal bankruptcies. And 70% of those people had medical health insurance at the time they're at the onset of their illness. Now, not all those medical conditions would be due to mental illnesses, but of those that don't have parity, a large number of those personal bankruptcies would be caused by a lack of parity. Thank you very much. And I have some of the empirical studies here, and there are also other empirical studies that show that the cost of parity is about 1% or less, which is consistent with a PEB board experience for the first year.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, I am Margaret Knoll. I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and thank you very much for allowing us to testify today. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. One of the things we do is to study issues. Nationally, we have studied health care, and we consider mental health care as part of the basic health care that should be provided for all citizens. We also have studied mental health in Oregon, and the Oregon League of Women Voters for the last few legislative sessions has supported parity for mental health and substance abuse care. We certainly support Senate Bill 1. I'm not going to repeat all of the things that have been said. Some of that is in my written testimony. We definitely feel that lack of insurance parity and treatment for mental health and substance abuse disorders has significant cost to society, both in terms of lost productivity, which has certainly been mentioned, suicide, crime, and certainly devastating effects on families. So the League would definitely urge you to move Senate Bill 1 forward. I want to also just speak from a personal viewpoint. My family is fortunate to have had reasonably good health insurance and to have pretty good personal resources. But we had a daughter who, as a teenager, had an eating disorder, and we paid a lot of out-of-pocket expenses to have her get health care for what was potentially a life-threatening disease. And I think now she's 24, she's very productive, she has a job teaching children, and I think the fact that she was able to get care for this mental disorder, which many teenagers do have, eating disorders, was instrumental to her becoming a productive adult and being able to do so well with her life. And now she's also very sympathetic and empathetic with other people who struggle with different kinds of mental illness. So I would urge you, from a personal viewpoint as well as from the League, to move Senate Bill 1 forward and pass it out of committee and shepherd it through the rest of the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Comments? Discussion? Thank you. At this point, there's just one more proponent, Dolores Hubert. Is there any... And
I signed in, but I signed in after you started.
As a proponent. And you may come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dolores Hubert. I am a retired nurse. I come from the great city of Portland and Gresham. It's a pleasure for me to be here today. I'm not going to reiterate testimony. I'm here to say that the Commission fully supports Senate Bill 1. And I'd just like to end quickly and allow others to testify by saying that this is a good bill whose time has come and consumers really do need it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Vincent Salvi. I live at 6425 Southwest 34th Avenue in Portland. I've given your assistant copies of written testimony. Just wanted to share the experience that I've had in my family on this particular issue. My eldest son, Nicholas, who just turned 21 on Sunday, a beautiful young man who just finished his first year in high school in Portland, a talented musician and a talented tennis player, earned his varsity letter in his freshman year, had a severe mental breakdown on the second day of our family vacation in Central Oregon in the summer of 2000. We were told at the time it was a psychotic break. I had never heard of psychotic breaks, but it was certainly Jekyll and Hyde. One day he was normal, functioning, happy. The very next day he was psychotic and out of control. And through that disbelief and heartache and confusion and fear and tears that we felt, I also felt a great deal of hope for him. Because I believed, and I was the first thing I thought of after we found that we couldn't get him medical care in Central Oregon, had to bring him home to Portland, and were shepherded between a number of different hospitals to try and find him care, I believed I had good medical care and it wouldn't be a problem. That night as we left him at Emanuel Hospital, I went and checked my policy and affirmed that I had $1 million in health care coverage, and I reassured my wife that we wouldn't have to worry about paying for the hospitalization. Unfortunately, I was sadly mistaken, as I learned after his third hospitalization in 3 months, that our care ran out after 21 days. On that third hospitalization, his diagnosis was reversed. He'd been diagnosed with manic depression. The new doctor, because he had been moved to Providence, or we'd been referred to Providence after Emmanuel was no longer able to take him, his new doctor said that wasn't an appropriate diagnosis, but she wasn't able to offer a diagnosis. She said, based on her clinical experience, that it would oftentimes take 2 years to observe and try and diagnose an adolescent. I didn't tell my wife. I guaranteed the hospital that we'd make payment, although I wasn't sure how we'd do it. We didn't have the money available, but I clearly would have taken a second mortgage. I would have drained my retirement account. I was advised by my family and the doctor over and over again not to do that, but I would have done so if I could have gotten him care. Sorry, it's a little emotional to remember this stuff, although it's been 5 years now. Next psychiatrist in Providence didn't think he was making any progress, and he wasn't after 10 days. And she made arrangements to transfer him to the Oregon State Hospital. She indicated that he thought, or she thought he could be there for up to 3 to 6 months or more, but she couldn't tell for sure. She advised us again not to try and bankrupt ourselves, to try and provide for his care, and I really pled, thanks. Sorry. to see whether we could keep him there a little bit longer. And she agreed to try a new regimen of antipsychotics for him with some hope, but not a lot, that there might be a change. Fortunately, within a day or two, there was a very slight improvement in his condition. The hospital agreed that we would be able to make payment, that they wouldn't force him out due to lack of insurance. And after another 2 weeks, he was released and was given a functionality, I'm not sure the appropriate way to phrase this, of 33 out of a normal functioning of 100. He was barely functioning, but we took him home. To me, the issue wasn't the cost, but we had a $24,000 bill at that point, and I didn't tell my wife. There was too much else to deal with. Over the next many months, we thought we'd have to hospitalize him many, many, many times. He was very psychotic, but we really wanted to try and keep him at home and see if we could manage him there. That was really difficult. We had two other children. He was violent at times. He was uncontrollable at times. But we managed to make it through that period, oftentimes with very heroic help from a new pediatric psychiatrist at OHSU. I had never heard of parity before my son's diagnosis. In fact, I didn't hear about it until quite a bit afterwards. And as you've heard, so many other states have now adopted it as the right thing to do. For my family, it would have meant not just saving money, and to me, it was never saving money. It would have meant the ability to see our son at his hospital and not know that he was in Salem and having no idea whether we could see him frequently or not. It would have meant the peace of mind that we wouldn't have had a mortgage to the house or perhaps deprive our other children, but I would have done that if necessary. For me, it was the ability to keep up a reasonable work schedule, although my wife, who is a teacher, took 6 weeks off, and that was a major impact on her school. I, fortunately, was only needed to take about plus or minus 10 days off because I had that commitment to try and work with his doctors and his counselors to see what we could do for him. Ultimately, it was the local resources in Portland through Providence Hospital that helped Nick toward recovery. A year later, he was back in school. He graduated on time. And it was through heroic efforts of people who were incredibly generous to us. He was diagnosed ultimately with schizoaffective disorder. He's on Social Security disability now. He is attending one class, God bless him, at Clackamas Community College. But that's all he can do, and I can't maintain him on my health insurance any longer. He's on the Oregon Health Plan, and I strongly advocate maintaining that to the extent you can. For me and for my family, parity would have meant not just the economic benefit, but the social benefit of being able to see our son, to work with his doctors, to try and get him community care. We were able to do that because he stayed in Portland. If he was at the Oregon State Hospital, it would have been much more difficult for us to maintain that contact or to work with local resources for me to see him. You know, it's something I thought about a lot, that if Nick had gone to the Oregon Hospital, State Hospital, that the cost to the state would have been very high. And I had estimated in my testimony $35,000 to $65,000, but there's no way to know how long he would have been there. If that was covered by private insurance, then the cost obviously would have been shared among the private insurers, a great deal of savings to the state. We didn't know if Nick would need future hospital care. I don't know if he will in the future, and I pray that he doesn't. He suffered greatly, but he's shown a lot of courage. And I ask you as a committee to show the same courage in passing this legislation, because it will give hope to those families that experience the type of mental illness that my family has. There is hope, but there's a need to try and provide for that in a way which is meaningful. I am absolutely confident that parity will help save employers' lost work time, not just from those who suffer, but from those who help to care for those who suffer. It will help reduce the cost of the state by avoiding the cost that the state picks up under Medicaid, and will allow families to help try and reintegrate their family members into the community, which is such an important part, and I've learned that over and over again now, on trying to assist those with mental illness. It's been a five-year journey for us. I'm positive that it's a lifetime journey, but I know by providing care locally that there's tremendous benefit. And my son is functioning now. He is still disabled and will be for his whole life, but he's functioning in a way that gives us joy and hope. So I ask for your support. I'm sorry I've been a little emotional here, but I really appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments, questions? Senator Evel Gordley will sum up the proponent's view.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Evel Gordley. I represent Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland. You have my written testimony, and I'm not going to read all of that. I'm going to go to the last page and just focus there on what I believe is the opportunity in front of us. And I sit here this afternoon as a mother, as a parent of a son who has lived with mental illness, who is finding his way to a productive life because there are treatments and medications that that work. And I also proudly sit here as a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, knowing that there are many members sitting behind me, and I feel their support and encouragement. Senate Bill 1 is an example of the kind of public policy legislators should aspire to create. This bill ranks with the best of laws produced in this great institution. It addresses a significant problem that impacts the entire state. It eliminates discrimination and rights a historical wrong. It makes good fiscal sense. Again, I'm honored to stand with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and I look forward to the day that this bill takes effect, because at that moment, discrimination and the barrier to treatment will fall for many of our most vulnerable Oregonians. And so I ask you, my colleagues, to vote in support of this bill and to do so with enthusiasm. Pass Senate Bill 1 out of this committee with a clear signal that this body is determined to leave behind the stigma, determined to leave behind the stereotypes around mental illness, and determined to end discrimination now. Let us leave this building at sine die knowing that no matter what else the session brings, we, the 73rd Legislative Assembly, did accomplish this one great and good thing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. I now call Elise Brown, Lisa Tressel, and Patrick Pine.
Madam Chair, we have a three-part summary here, so in the interest of time, we'd like to shoot one right after the other and entertain questions at the end. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans. AHIP is the national organization representing HMOs, PPOs, and other network-based health plans. Our member organizations arrange for health care services for approximately 170 million members nationwide. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today on the important issue of insurance coverage for mental health care services. AHIP and its member plans believe in the value of quality mental health services. In fact, health plan coverage and management of these services has resulted in millions of Americans having access to mental health care. Oregon first required mental health benefits for group insurance plans in 1975. In 87, Oregon combined mental health and chemical dependency coverage laws and established dollar limits for adults, children, and adolescents. In 99, Oregon increased the minimum dollar coverage requirements for mental health and chemical dependency by 25%. Today, 1.1 million Oregonians are covered by group products. We believe that existing mental health and chemical dependency mandates meet the needs of an overwhelming majority of individuals covered by group health insurance. And I wanted to share just a couple of numbers that have been provided by Regents. 99% of those who access residential services completed care before exhausting benefits. 98% of those who access outpatient services completed care before exhausting. And 90% of those who access inpatient services completed care benefits before they were exhausted. These numbers tell us that very few are exhausting their benefits. AHIP and our member plans are committed to continuing the work to expand Americans' access to effective mental health benefits. However, we respectfully oppose doing so through mandates that have largely been responsible for increasing access to benefits. Increased costs associated with these mandates would lead many employers to drop coverage, thereby reducing access to what we have today with mental health care and other health services. Mental health parity is estimated to increase claims paid by commercial carriers approximately 2.5% industry-wide. So rather than benefit consumers with over-expansive benefits, there's unintended consequences that go along with that. And in particular, at a time when we're in this building trying to figure out how to deal with keeping what we have today. And now I'll have Lori. For Lisa.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI. And here today just to raise some concerns as you consider this public policy issue. With the last session, there was a number that was that we had that indicated that for a 1% increase in premium, 3,000 Oregonians lost their coverage. And I don't have that statistic for this session yet, but I can't imagine that it had has fluctuated too much from last session. So even as we look at a bill that will increase costs 0.5%, 1%, 1.5%, 2.5%, my point would be that there will be people who will lose coverage because of this additional benefit. And I'd like you to look at the charts I put in front of you, the colored charts with the blue and the green. And these are off of the insurance division's website, and it talks about the small employer market. And for the areas that, Madam Chair, you're in, is graphic, it's the geographic area 1, and I believe Senators Cruz and Morissette are in 2, and President Courtney is in 3. And what I'd like to just point out on the chart is that this is the employee cost under the basic plan that employers are paying, and then if you move to the PPO plan, that first column is the employee-only benefit. In the small group market, most of the employers that we have surveyed in the past are paying anywhere from 75% to 100% of the employee-only benefit. And they will provide coverage for their employees' dependents, but the employee has to pay the difference. The third column under each of these, under basic plan and the PPO plan, the third column over is the employee and family coverage. And as you can see, the prices throughout the areas, I think the cheapest one on here is just under $1,000, and they go upwards from there. You'll see some that are hitting $2,000. So the concern is that if the increase was only 2%, it might be that you add 2% to the employee-only contribution, and employers can they can find the dollars to cover that. But the concern is over on the employee and family, that the individual paying for dependent coverage, that might be the straw that breaks the camel's back. So that's just something we wanted to indicate, that it, when you provide a benefit and it's a policy decision, that's kind of what you have to weigh, is the benefit versus the cost. The other handout I gave you, the booklet I think you've all seen before, it was IPBG created it, Insurance Pool Governing Board, and that's a list of the 25 mandates that
are currently in Oregon statute. 25 benefits that the legislature has indicated should be in every group policy sold. And I believe the current mental health benefits start on page 3 and 4 of that package, of that pamphlet. One of the thoughts is that while you're we're prioritizing things, everyone's looking at ways to control the cost of health care. I haven't recently reviewed the 25 mandates, but it might be that some of those 25 mandates are no longer as high a priority. And if we're going to prioritize things, maybe there's something in there that we could do without while we're looking at passing an additional one. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Patrick to talk about it from a perspective of a benefits purchaser for an employer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Pine. I'm corporate benefits manager for ESCO Corporation. I also chair AOI's Health Policy Advisory Committee. My testimony today is to indicate some concerns that we have with effectively achieving the positive intentions of Senate Bill 1. Quick background might be in order. ESCO employs about 700 persons today at our Portland facilities. We also employ over 400 in California, which has a very similar form of mental health parity. We employ over 200 in Mississippi, a little over 100 in Kentucky, another 100-plus employees in Arizona, and we have smaller numbers of employees in several other locations in several states. We provide a variety of medical and dental benefits to employees in each of these locations using a variety of plan providers. We are currently fully insured, but in the recent past, we have provided some benefits at some locations on a self-insured basis. As a result of our multi-state operations, we do deal with different mandates in different states. In California, as I've already noted, we have a form of mental health parity quite similar to the proposal in Senate Bill 1. But in Colorado, for instance, we do not necessarily have that mandate, but we have a mandate to provide durable medical equipment for diabetics, a mandate which we have in no other location. In Oregon, we currently provide three options to our employees for medical insurance, a plan through what is known as a multi-employer trust, a plan through PacificCare, and a plan through Kaiser Permanente. Currently, about 60% of our employees are electing the multi-employer trust option. Roughly 35% are electing Kaiser. A very small number are electing PacificCare. I should just add the costs are indicative of why those people choose. Generally, the multi-employer trust is the cheapest of the options. PacificCare is the most expensive, so you would expect that kind of selection. A multi-employer trust plan is an indemnity-type plan. One may go to any doctor, and after meeting a deductible, will have, generally speaking, 80% of the total bill reimbursed. That plan is not subject to any state benefit mandates, such as proposed in Senate Bill 1, because the state regulation of benefits through vehicles other than commercial insurance is preempted by the federal statute known as ERISA. Many employers in Oregon do sponsor plans that are essentially self-insured or otherwise exempted or preempted by ERISA. Generally speaking, self-insured plans which are exempted by ERISA will not have the same type of benefits as were envisioned by Senate Bill 1. If Senate Bill 1 were in effect, I think it's fair to say that in most of those cases, it's unlikely that the employers with those type of plans would add this level of benefits, mainly due to the cost in the current market condition. As a personal note, I do want to add something that's somewhat painful to me. I have two nephews in two different households, both of whom are dealing with the challenges associated with mental health care. I know very firsthand and painfully about the financial and emotional challenges involved. One happens to be in a household where his parents are lucky because they are employed by an insurer who happens or by a company that has an insured group plan with has substantial mental health benefits, and that has greatly eased the financial burden on my one nephew's family because they happen to have that kind of arrangement. My other nephew, however, is in a family where by virtue of their employment, they're with an employer who is largely self-insured and does not have the kind of benefits that are envisioned in Senate Bill 1. And so that family, also one of my relatives, has been left to carry most of the burden of his care. However, if I step back just a little bit, it's hard for me to say why one nephew's mandated benefits or coverage is more warranted than the other nephew's. And I have to tell you that Senate Bill 1 will not change the circumstance for either of my nephews. It is also my understanding that Section 1 provisions do not apply to Medicare, to the Veterans Administration system, to the individual insured market, nor to the uninsured population. Therefore, my point is that Senate Bill 1 only applies to a minority of the working population and the total populace, only those who have fully insured group plans not subject to federal preemption. I want to just change signals for a moment and talk about the cost issue. While some proponents of parity contend that the total cost of health care might fall if parity existed, that presumption is largely based on these benefits being available to a large segment of the population. In fact, our experience to date in California has been that its version of parity has thus far added at least 1% to the monthly premium, and perhaps as much as 5% depending on the particular plan and group and the particular plan year. We've had about 6 years of experience in California, so I have some high degree of familiarity with that situation. In the first year of implementation in California in 1999, there was an increase in California insured plan premiums, at least in our case, something over 5% in the first year. In subsequent years, the annual increment attributed to parity, which is very difficult to do, has run somewhere between 1 and 5%, depending on the group and the plan and the year. To date, we have not seen evidence of a net reduction in our costs in California. My personal best guess, based on our experience in California, is that mental health parity has added something over 2% to the total premium and something more in actual total cost. Now, I did hear the prior testimony about maybe some other costs are offset. I have to tell you, we've analyzed it for our California population over the last several years. And in answer to the argument that you will improve productivity with these benefits, at least in California, we haven't been able to document improvements in our attendance of our general workforce. Attendance is not different today than it was 6 years ago. Nor have we seen reduced medical claims on the medical side after parity was started in California. Now, that is the experience of my corporation. Other people might have a different experience. I also want to mention something that I think Lisa already mentioned. While it might appear that a small incremental cost addition may not sound like very much, if we look at monthly premiums now for families which are totaling $1,000 a month or more, and they're rising and forecast to rise continually at another 10% or more annually for the near-term future, every increment of cost, no matter how small, does become crucial to consideration of employers and employees. A 1% addition to $1,000 is $10 per month. Past studies that I think Lisa already indicate that every 1% premium increase ultimately causes somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 Oregonians to lose insurance altogether. While it's very difficult to precisely measure, there is no doubt that some population segment will lose some insurance coverage for each additional dollar of premium cost. So the public policy dilemma is that while mental health parity does definitely benefit many, there is an invisible unknown number of individuals who will lose coverage altogether due to even a slight increase in cost. I'd like to close my remarks by just mentioning that I'd like you not to construe this testimony to reflect that we at our company or other companies in this state are insensitive to the needs of our employees and their dependents, nor are we insensitive to the needs of the greater community. Rather, we do find that mandates that only apply to selective groups make it harder for us to provide equitable, comprehensive, consistent benefits to all of our employees without forcing the curtailment of other non-mandated benefits or that some other group of individuals may lose insurance entirely. It's analogous to the extremely difficult choices you struggle with every day to meet the enormous competing demands for numerous legitimate needs while working with limited resources. And like you, each decision to fund one of those needs, legitimate needs, will inevitably mean that some other competing legitimate demand probably cannot be met. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any discussion? It looks like we have no other people here to testify. I do want to cite for the record letters that we have received from Mitchell Anderson from the Benton County Health Department, who is in favor of mental health parity, Senate Bill 1, as well as a letter from Judy Redler, and let's see, I'm not sure where she is from, but she also has a letter. She's from NAMI, National Association for Mental Illness, Clackamas County, also in favor of Senate Bill 1. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yes, I do have a letter that I think all of us have received from Linda Trexel, a three-page email letter addressed to the committee that should be entered into the record. We've all received this letter.
Thank you. This is yours, Mary. Okay. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1. And I want to start with just a couple of comments before I ask for a motion. I know that the opponents do talk about the increased costs that this may prove, and I counter with the fact that I do not believe in denying services to a specific population with a certain disease or disorder. That's why I feel very strongly about this bill. And I also want to bring to the attention of the opponents that there are several other bills, I call them the 500 series bills, that where we are looking at cost containment. There are a number of different ways that we can bring down health care costs, and that's why I feel it's critical for us to focus on those areas rather than focusing on people who actually have a disease or a disorder and having them bear the brunt of not receiving coverage. We have to look at other ways of bringing down our health care costs, and that's what we are doing in this committee. Therefore, Senator Courtney.
Chair. I move Senate Bill 1 to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved that Senate Bill 1 be moved to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator George.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I left a few minutes ago. You saw me gone, and I was making a few phone calls based upon something that I read in the fiscal analysis of this proposed legislation. And I was very troubled by a comment relative to local government. And they make this statement, if I could read from this.
Yes.
It can be reasonably concluded that local government offering group health plans, by the way, I found out that almost every one of them, other than a very, very small little town who may have one employee, does do that, that they would experience additional cost. And they go on to talk about the fact that they may not be able to respond to this as far as the cost. Well, we know what the costs are. We've seen some of the numbers. The response that I got from the people I was able to reach was, we do not favor this bill. We just cannot take any more pressure. These are the same folks who are going to be facing the majority of the cost that from the decision on PERS. And I just cannot put a bill out here that is going to have these kind of consequences on local government, so I will be a no vote.
Any other further discussion? Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was truly moved by the presentations by those of you who have family members who are suffering from a mental disease, and I was particularly impressed with the testimony about the brain being a body part which can be damaged either at birth or by an accident or by a substance, and I think it's a fairness issue. I just think it's if we do have the means to cover things which are necessary for individuals who through no fault of their own can't cope, we have a moral obligation, I believe, to do so. It also, I think, is cost effective, and I think people are in denial. They don't want to talk about the cost shift. I mean, you can talk about passing a cost on to local government. It's local government who ends up taking care of people in the jails and in the Johnson unit of Sacred Heart Hospital, which I'm getting information on. There are people referred to the Johnson unit, and they are charity cases. I just think that there is a huge cost shift that we somehow don't want to recognize because we're concerned about passing 1% or 0.5% on. I think that's, well, it's bad public policy. So I definitely will vote yes on this bill.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
it's interesting that Senator Morissette talks about we. Well, this isn't a we thing. I mean, we can't do things. I mean, if this bill had an impact on government, it would have to go to Ways and Means. It has an impact on the private sector. We can do it with impunity, which I think is really rather interesting. I don't want people to get the idea I'm not in favor of mental health and chemical dependency parity, because I am. I was on Governor Kitzhaber's mental health work group, and we spent an inordinate amount of time on that. I think one of my concerns, one of them is we're looking at several insurance mandates in this session. There's also been talk all session long about a surcharge on insurance. And to look at these individual pieces of this separately from the aggregated whole, I think, is irresponsible. I also think that we are limiting choice. And I know it was mentioned that somebody tried to buy mental health coverage and couldn't. I don't believe that. I have a personal passion in this area. I'm personally a recovering person. Next month I will celebrate 19 years clean, and I went through treatment to get there, and my insurance paid for that treatment, and it saved my life. So I have a personal stake in this. I don't think this gets us there. To pass this bill and say we have achieved parity, we haven't. We achieve parity when we fix our broken mental health delivery system. We achieve parity when we solve the problem of the state hospital and when we get group facilities out in communities so that people can get appropriate treatment and we're able to fund those appropriately. So we're saying we've reached parity because we passed off another cost to the private sector rather than stepping up to the plate and dealing with the bigger picture ourselves. And that truly, truly bothers me. I think that appropriate treatment is a responsible thing to do. But I look at my own business, and I look at the insurance coverage that I offer my employees. We include some things and exclude some things based on what they want to have covered. And if we have to cover everything, we won't be able to offer it anymore. And that is a real concern to me, because my employees are part of my extended family, and I don't want to leave them out in the cold, and I don't want to pass off the cost to them. And if we add all the mandates we're talking about, I may be forced to do that, and that's a place I do not want to go.
Any other further discussion? Yes. Senator Courtney.
I want to make sure everybody understands that this session is reviewing a massive movement on the mental health front. Starting back in the November e-board, where in a very bipartisan way, the governor's office, the speaker, the president's office, and all members of Ways and Means supported the allocation of money to create new beds, as well as to reallocate our beds that are at the state hospitals, the local level. Presently, a master plan is underway by a very well-known and respected organization out of San Francisco. We hope to have the master plan draft form on May 2nd and full form May 16th or 18th, which will review not only the state hospital but our delivery system of the mental health approach in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 1 is a part of that massive movement. I do think that this session has the opportunity and to confront the mental health situation in our state, not only in terms of parity, but facilities and treatments, not only at the state level, but the local level. And so this is part of that. Rather than see it as a mandate, and I know that it will be called that, it is another part of this massive effort to try to deal with the mental health issue in our state, as all Oregonians want to. So I think Senate Bill 1 is a major part of that, and I'm proud to move it forward and proud to be voting for it.
Also, for the record, we did get a fiscal analysis of the proposed legislation, and it says the fiscal impact of this measure on state and local agencies cannot be determined with precision. There's an actuarial analysis by Blue Cross Blue Shield in 2003 that estimated that the parity provisions would increase premiums by maybe 1.5%. The Public Employees Benefit Board policies offer parity, and their experience was a 0.5% increase. And the Insurance Pool Governing Board reports that history of policy premiums for the past 18 months reflects that when additional benefits are mandated, insurers use means other than premium increases to accommodate the added benefit, such as modifying non-mandated portions of the coverage. So the measure would apply to policies issued or renewed on or after January 1st, 2007. It looks like we're in work session, Senator.
Call him up if you'd like.
But if you wanted to come up and say a few words, and then we will call the roll for a vote on this bill.
But you don't get to vote.
Well, at the risk of potentially negatively impacting the vote, I will be very brief. Senator Ben Westland, Senate District 27. I just want to say how important this bill is to so many people. I mean, many of you know, I mean, my medical history is a open book, and while I've been through some trials and tribulations, what I and my family have been through is absolutely nothing. A walk in the park with people throwing rose petals at our feet compared to the suffering of those that endure chronic and severe mental illness. There is no more insidious, impactful condition that affects us as citizens, people, human beings. This is an important bill. I know you know that. I'll stop my remarks there. I know there's good fiscal analysis, and there's every reason. I mean, this is a great bill for every reason. For humanity, for fiscal cost containment. It's just the right thing to do. Thank you all very much. I apologize for the lateness of my testimony.
That's all right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Portney?
Yes.
Senator George?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chairman Sanderson?
Aye. Senate Bill 1 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Meeting adjourned.
Keep it out of the way for me.
What?
Committee on Environment and Land Use. Today is Wednesday, March 9th, 2005, 3 p.m. We're in Hearing Room B, chaired by Senator Atkins.
I'm just looking in the back way here. These are...